Here we are, people. Podcast number 20. Today on the show, we have Josh Boyd. Josh is one of the best public land hunters that I personally know. He's written for Eastman's and Rockslide. He works in the woods almost every day for the U.S. Forest Service and just has a lot of great information for backcountry and public hunters. As always, you can get 20% off at Mountain Ops by using the code FATKID. We'd really appreciate that. Follow us on AveryAdventures.com and check out our YouTube channel, Avery Adventures. Thanks. Hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to the Avery Adventures podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Avery.
And I'm Tanya Avery.
Today on the show, we have Josh Boyd. Josh Boyd hails from the great state of Montana. If you read Eastman's or you get online, you get on Rockslide, you've seen lots of writings, lots of pictures, lots of backcountry hunting from Josh. And I think one of the unique things that nobody knows about Josh is he has what I consider a very awesome job that makes so he can spend a lot of time in the woods. And he also is, a great writer and photographer. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Thanks, you guys. Appreciate you guys having me over.
Yeah, well, he came down to our house. He lives up by Libby, Montana, and he drove down in the snowy weather to do the podcast. So we appreciate that.
Very much.
I do have to say, though, that the great state of Montana is a little overrated. So, yeah,
really?
Idaho might be better.
How so? Let's elaborate on that.
The hunting's really not that great.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. I would actually tell people to stay out of both states. They both suck.
Colorado is where it's at, what I hear.
Sure. Colorado, Wyoming, there's no real reason to go to Idaho or Montana.
Yeah, just call Aaron Snyder. He'll take you out and show you all his favorite spots.
Yeah, call Aaron. Call Gritty.
Oh, yeah. Gritty is great about that.
They'll show you around the greater Denver area. Hey, they have way better mule deer than us. Just ask them.
They do.
And more elk than any other state.
Yeah.
So I don't know why that anybody would want to hunt in Idaho and Montana personally.
I can't think of a reason.
Actually, there was just a post on Rockslide for a unit. And I love unit posts because there's no better way to ruin a unit than to talk about it online. But they were talking about all the Washingtonians in southern Idaho and we have just as many Washingtonians in northern Idaho.
Northwest Montana is the same way. Yeah.
And I'm really not hammering on Washingtonians, but anywhere you go, you're going to run into out-of-staters is basically what I'm trying to tell people.
Right. That's not – he is – every summer we see more Washington plates than Idaho plates up where we like to go, and there's not kind words uttered, honestly.
I just don't like people in general, but the probably the funniest story is we were up camping. There's a bunch of Washingtonians, and I was just driving around looking at all these places to swim, and you couldn't find a place to swim. So we're driving around, and my daughter was probably 3 or 4. And I just kind of blurted under my breath, "Fucking people." And I shook my head. And the next day, I picked up Tanya because she was somewhere working, and she came up, and we're driving around, and all of a sudden from the back seat, "Fucking people," from my daughter. We're like, "Oh, yeah."
That was before we actually really knew that they swore as badly as we do.
Yeah.
It was. So, you have a daughter.
I do.
You'll see.
She's 3 and a half. Okay. And I definitely have caught myself saying stuff like, "Oh, I hope that does not get repeated."
Oh, it will.
Especially in front of mom.
Yeah. No, it will for sure.
And if she's anything like our daughters or my kids, if you tell them, "Don't tell mom," the first thing they do is tell mom when they see
her. Right.
Yep.
No, they actually will fight to get out of the car in order to tattle on the other parent. It's not just me getting tattle on. Ryan gets it too. So if either one of us do something, they will beat each other up to try to be the first one to tattle on the other
parent.
They do.
They actually run down just to tell the other parent. That's pretty awesome.
That's funny.
And then Ryan's like, "You're not telling on me. I don't get in trouble." And they're like, "Yeah, you do."
Yeah, some way or another, you husbands out there know you pay one way or the other.
Yeah, but back to not liking people, that's... And not seeing people in the woods. That is why I like where I live.
Yeah,
it's awesome.
You do live in a kind of a segregated part of Montana.
It's out of the way. There's not much going on up there. You know, fortunately and unfortunately, but it's a great place to live if you can deal with the drawbacks of it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's hard to get in and out of there. If you travel a lot, it's hard to fly out of there because you got to drive somewhere to fly.
Yeah, it's 2.5 to 3 hours to any airport.
Wow.
And it's like Northwest Montana, I would even say worse than the units that I hunt, unless you're hunting Unit 1 in Idaho. It's the terrain is not conducive for glassing.
No.
Yeah. So you're basically, you kind of got to know a place to think, well, I've seen animals here before, and then walk to that spot. And so I know a lot of people, and we talked about a little bit, come up and they hunt with me, and I'm sure you've had it too. They come up in Northwest Montana and they're like, this place sucks. And not saying that there's not animals there. It's just, you can't find them. You can't glass them. So you're basically walking in the dark, trying to find animals.
Yeah, it's the animal concentration is low, and it's brushy, and it's steep, and they're tough to find. It's, you might be able to glass across a drainage and see three mule deer in an avalanche chute standing in alder.
Right.
But good luck getting over there and killing them.
Right. And there's very little alpine.
Right.
That's the number one thing that I hear from people out of state, Colorado, Utah especially. Aaron, my cousin, came up, and my other cousins came up from Roosevelt, Utah, and they're like, you think that there's like benches and alpines and nice places you see animals feeding.
No.
If you've ever been up northern part of Idaho or northwest Montana, it's trees from the bottom to the top. Mm-hmm. And when you do break out of the trees, you're just in almost sheer rocks.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So, well, tell us a little bit about your job. You have a unique job and a job that actually gets you out in the woods more often than most people.
Yeah. Well, I work for the Forest Service in the Department of Hydrology. So I look at and analyze rivers and streams.
Is there a degree for that?
Yeah, there is.
Wow.
Yeah, any type of surface water hydrology degree.
Nice.
We'll get you there for the most part.
Did people tell you that when you got into that, that's probably going to be a low-paying job like a teacher?
No. It doesn't pay all that great.
Right. The job. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I'm not starving either. Don't get me wrong.
Well, I'd rather have your job than teach with some snotty-nosed kids, too.
Oh, hands down. Yeah.
So if you're going to be a government employee, you have the job.
It's not a bad one. So I'm in the field a lot. So I measure stream volume, sediment numbers, look at the health of the streams overall, some fish habitat, you know, how it plays into fish habitat, and analyze that information, write reports. I'm in the field a lot. I'm standing in streams. I'm walking up and down them. I'm hiking to high mountain lakes sometimes to get water quality samples. I snowmobile up and ski into areas where I sampled snowpack, which kind of tells us kind of what our runoff potential could be. I do some design and implementation of like stream restoration work. So I'm out like surveying streams to a really fine detail and then implementing those projects at a later date when we can find some funding to do it.
So you guys are probably big in the funding of bull trout.
Oh, that drives a lot of the work that we do.
I imagine.
Yeah. Is to fix habitat that's degraded.
I always wonder on that in North Idaho, especially like we talked about Lightning Creek. Mm. Lightning Creek's a spot where the bridges, they cannot keep roads or bridges because of the high water runoff. Mm-hmm. Is the Forest Service, I have no idea, and a lot of people, are they proactive on that? So if you have a drainage like that, is like Lightning Creek, that just blows out bridge after bridge after bridge, do you guys have a plan for that? Or is it the bridge is gone again, we got to go in there? Do you guys look at it as a long-term saying, we got to do something different to fix that problem?
Well, yeah. Common sense would dictate that we would either remove the roads potentially or remove the bridges or upsize the bridges or move the roads to a different location within the drainage where they're not so susceptible to runoff and erosion and blowouts. But the funding that comes with fixing destruction of property is ERFO money. I don't know, Cameron, what the acronym stands for. It's some emergency relief money. ERFO dictates that we have to replace it as it was. So a lot of the times the bridges are too small in the first place to handle these big floods, so the bridge blows out. But then if we want to upsize it, ERFO's like, well, we're only going to fund it so it is an in-kind replacement.
So instead of fixing it for good, you band-aid it with the same thing.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's not obviously knocking the Forest Service. It's just kind of the laws
that are
in place.
No, and that's a lot of that's federal highway dollars, I believe, that dictate that.
So if you have a road in the Forest Service that's maintained by the Forest Service that falls under the highway department? No.
If it gets blown out under like an emergency situation, like the big floods of Lightning Creek that happened in 96, 97, they blew out a bunch. They just blew out in 2016, or 15, December of 15, a bunch of them blew out. And I think there's a couple circumstances where they'll allow you to upgrade stuff if they fixed it enough. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the third time we fixed this bridge, and we're not going to do it again the same way. A lot of times, there's a little bit of give there, but for the most part, just the way that mechanism works doesn't make a lot of sense a lot of the time.
So do you guys ever have to wait when there's like other natural disasters happening around the country? Do you get put to the bottom of the list, or is it dictated by state?
It's just dictated by the event. Okay. So it doesn't happen that frequently. Mm-hmm. I think the last time where I work on the Kootenai, I think the last big IRFO money that we had available was like 2006. Wow. We had a big rain on snow event in November, and it was like a 500-year storm event, and that's when a lot of the stuff in Lightning Creek unraveled as well. A lot of their bridges came out, pipes blew out, roads washed away, the channel was braided. That was the last time I've ever really been around like an emergency fund like that. So it doesn't happen that frequently.
Do they like elk? You know, the Forest Service will shut down. I'm sure they work obviously with the fish and game divisions, but do they shut down roads and bridges for fish like they do for elk?
No. Well, I mean, we will shut down roads sometimes for water quality concerns. Like, we'll put like a seasonal closure on it sometimes. Like, it'll be closed during the wettest time of the year when the surface of the road can be damaged from like rutting of tires, which could route water and sediment off that road into the streams. But a lot of our roads are closed for other reasons, mostly like grizzly bear concerns. Yeah,
that makes sense. So
we're in a recovery area up there in Northwest Montana, and I want to say we're not even halfway there for the population level. So a lot of what we do is dictated, like on the ground wise, like as far as like outside of the stream channels, a lot of that's dictated by grizz and with our road system. But we also try to minimize the risk to water quality and fisheries as well by managing the road systems. But a lot of that, and I know there's a lot of people opposed to it, but a lot of that is by decommissioning unnecessary roads that are failing, falling off the hillside. So that's part of some of the work that we do as well. Stabilizing unstable portions of road, or roads and culverts that are not needed anymore and have a potential to blow out. Like culverts will plug, water will overtop the road, erode the material into the stream, plug up pools, that type of stuff.
That big invasive thing that's going on right now, does that have anything to do with any of the streams outside of the lake, big bodies of water? You know, they're pulling all those boats over in all the states.
That is a huge threat to our fisheries and our natural resources all over the West.
What is that? What are they talking about?
They are looking for any type of aquatic invasive. So it could be anything from plants, like the milfoil, Eurasian milfoil, which is in like Knoxon Reservoir. They don't want that to spread to other water bodies, which is, I don't know the ins and outs of it all that much, but that stuff, it seems like it just proliferates, and it'll plug up shallow water, sucks up extra oxygen in the summer when the water's warm. You have a lot of fish kills. So a lot of people can't recreate on some of these lakes, so it just forms these huge mats on the water. Yeah, so it's a lot of swimming holes and good fishing holes get plugged up by it. And it's mostly, I mean, it can be found in rivers, but it's mostly persists in either slow-moving rivers or reservoirs and lakes. But the other aquatic invasive stuff that I know Montana is really concerned with, and Idaho, are like the mussels.
Right, that's actually my...
The quagga mussels and the zebra mussels, I believe. They're not native to North America, but they've kind of been slowly popping up in water bodies all over the state. So,
and what's invasive about them? What do they do, the mussels in general?
It sounds like they will attach to just about any hard surface. And to docks, to outtakes of reservoirs, water body, like municipal water bodies, like where you get your city water. So if you have a reservoir or something, a lot of the pipes will get lined with it. The bottom of boats, it's just the pilings on docks get covered with it. And I don't know the ecological impacts of it. I haven't really looked into it that much. I mean, that's sort of more of a water ecology type of kind of specialty. I'm more like a hydrology, so I just basically look at the way water functions.
Right. Do you deal with any of the stuff that comes down, it's going to flood and you got to change something to make it not flood in a particular area? Or
Yeah. So a lot of the stuff that we do is when we design a channel, like we do a lot of channel work, not a lot, but we do some channel work where we're rebuilding rivers.
Like got excavators and stuff in there.
Yep.
Moving
excavators,
dirt.
Dump trucks, dozers, lots of heavy equipment. And some of it can be just putting it back into an original channel and calling it good if the original channel will kind of handle the flow and kind of meet the parameters of what we're looking to do and the outcomes. Or sometimes it's just like totally rebuilding a whole new channel. So we're rebuilding all the riffles and we're building new pools and runs and glides and, you know, scraping out of the floodplain the correct channel dimensions that we want. So we, you know, we're looking at the slopes, the depths, the entrenchment of the channel, how easily can it access a new floodplain. We build in sinuosity potentially. There's always sinuosity, but we look at how much we should put in it, whether we want a real meandering channel versus a more of a straight and slightly meandering. So it's, yeah, there's a lot that goes into designing and implementing new channel work and looking at floods and how they interact with the infrastructure in the drainage, be it bridges downstream or private property downstream. We have to be very cognizant that we don't do something that's going to screw something up down valley. So there's a lot of risk involved with it, and it's really rewarding when you get it all to come together and put it on the ground.
Well, that sounds like a really interesting job. It can't possibly be the same like every day. You know, you get to have this new, not monotonous job that you...
Yeah.
All these different challenges.
It sounds pretty exciting, and it is most of the time.
You made it sound really fascinating.
There is also like government red tape and minutiae that goes along with it.
Minutiae. I like that word.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Minutiae. It can get a little bit frustrating, but, you know, when the days that I do get frustrated, it's like I just got to step back a little bit and think about exactly what am I really frustrated about.
Right.
Is it really... I mean, I got a cool job. I live in an awesome location.
Still going back to the woods next
I'm
day.
In the, yeah, mm-hmm. I'm pulling on my Sims waders and
right.
tomorrow. And then I'm going to be right. out measuring this channel tomorrow. So it's fun.
So you get to hike and keep yourself in shape for your hunting seasons.
Yeah, I would say that
helps. The movement of the animals mm-hmm. in certain areas.
Yeah, that is another benefit is I get to travel around the forest and see different areas in ways that I normally would never go
right.
otherwise to recreate.
On that side, on the hunting side, so you spend a couple hundred days a year for your job in the woods.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're going to see stuff. Well, man, I got to go check that out later on for hunting and either write it down or make a mental note saying, I need to come back here, see some elk tracks or something.
Drop
pass
a
by.
Pin on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Does that happen to you?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. I'll be, I'll find sheds, you know, I'll be walking along down a creek bottom, you know, looking at a floodplain or something, and I'll find a set of whitetail sheds. Mm-hmm. I'm like, wow, where did this buck come from? Where did he live?
Exactly.
I know he was here this winter. He's can't be too far away this summer. And I'll, you know, maybe start thinking about that a little bit and kind of try to piece that puzzle together. Or, yeah, you get up, like, I'll do some high mountain lake stuff where I'll go grab water quality samples at some of these high lakes. And so it gets me up and out of the valley, and I can glass and
wait a minute.
Camp.
You take your binoculars with you when you go up and check
hydrology?
Shit, I would too.
Have you ever found a location that you had previously not known about doing this that you've had a successful hunt because of?
Yeah, I think, yeah, I have. I've actually, there's a mule deer spot an early season mule deer spot. I've never killed a mule deer there, but I've hunted them there, and I've had like really close calls.
Ah, nice.
But it's a spot that I get to go into almost every year and collect some information.
And you'll get a few emails about where that might be.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure
you get that anyways.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Have you ever met any crazy-ass hippies while you're hiking around the woods?
Yeah.
You got any good stories on
that? Yeah, well, actually, it wasn't at work,
crazy
but I ran into one dude. I was hunting down in central Montana. It was really hot, and I popped out of the woods. I popped out of the woods and I hit this old lot, like an old like homestead road, through the sagebrush and juniper and fir terrain, and I see this guy like just stumble out of the sagebrush, and he's wearing jeans and no shirt, and I see him kick back a big old finish off a bottle of whiskey with one big chug and then throw the bottle of whiskey out into the woods, and then he just turns and thank God he just started stumbling straight away from me.
Didn't even see me.
Popped out of
and
nowhere.
And so I kind of like stepped back into the shadows a little bit, and I watched him stagger over the rise down the road. I'm like, God dang it, that's the direction I need to hike out of here because my buddy's going to pick me up on the other side out on this open road. And so I gave him like 10 minutes, and I thought, he's down the road away. So I start following him out. And I pop over a rise, and he's standing there, like 20 feet away.
Cracking open another bottle.
Now he's just kind of looking off in the distance. He's in his own world. And this is like probably like 10 in the morning, and he is just hammered.
So where did he come from? Just walk up from the
He was living in some old miner shack that he threw some tarps over, and he'd been there squatting for a while. Wow. But he saw me, and he came over to me and started talking to me about all the dinosaur bones that were in the road that we were walking out of.
You didn't even know about those, did
you? No, but they were basically rocks sticking out. But he was telling, oh, that's a dinosaur. That one right there is worth a couple hundred thousand. And he has this giant knife on his belt, like a big Arkansas toothpick. And he whips it out to show it to me. And I took like 3 steps back. And he's like, where are you from? It's like, well, I live up northwest Montana. He's like, you guys are nervous up there. I'm like, well, when someone pulls a giant knife like that out, I give him some room.
I just tell him I'm not stealing your dinosaur bones.
He was all scraggly, long haired, beard. He just looked like a homeless guy. But I think he just finished that bottle of whiskey that morning. Probably started it that morning too. But anyway, I ended up walking out with him for a while, and then as soon as I could, I jumped into the woods and took a shortcut to my rendezvous site.
I don't blame you.
But yeah, I run into some strange people like that at work as well. Not quite that.
You ever
level.
Run into any big pot
fields? That's what I was just going to ask.
No.
No?
I never have. No. It sounds like there used to be a little bit of growing going on back in the like 70s and 80s up there, but I'm sure it does happen, but no, we've not had anything like that happen
in years.
They
moved to Washington.
Sounds like there's other places for it.
Yeah, you can do drive-thrus now and get that.
Yeah. Yeah, you can smell them. Like, Northern California, if you go down, like, in late August, early September, if you're driving around, like, Humboldt County, Trinity County,
Does it smell like Doritos?
Smells like a pack rat, maybe.
Really?
Yeah,
really?
It's
skunky-like?
It's like, oh, what's that? Yeah, it's like, what's that? It's like, that's pot.
Wow.
For sure.
Just baking in the sun, basically, the plants?
I'm sure they're reaching maturity, and it's when they start the harvest, and I don't really know the ins and outs of it. But
see a bunch of people run around thinking kumbaya.
Yeah. But it's like a bit, like down there in Northern California, that's a big economic driver for a lot of the folks that don't have a real job, and they kind of, I mean, that's, they go, so a lot of people go there to harvest.
Really?
Specifically for like a week or so, or a couple weeks. And hang out, and I guess they make decent money.
Never thought of that.
Well, in Denver, when they legalized it, it made an astronomical amount of revenue for, you know, taxes and stuff. Huh. It was insane.
We'd have to ask Heath.
We'd have to ask. Maybe I'll have Heath on the podcast.
He would tell us.
He's an expert.
So, getting back onto the hunting and the gear side of this podcast, I met Josh. Well, I found out about Josh. He shot a really big deer. And if you're watching the video of this, I'll get the deer picture from him and put it up on the video. Shot a really heavy buck with his bow back in 2004 or 5, somewhere in there.
Are you talking about that whitetail?
Yep.
Yeah, that was 2006.
Yep. And shortly after I read it, I actually ran into him at a 3D shoot in Libby. I went up there with Larry shooting a 3D shoot and ran into Josh and I went away from the whole conversation. Like, man, that's a really nice guy. And then if you guys have paid attention to Eastman's and the backcountry hunting side of the gear, Josh kept popping up and popping up and popping up. So I told my partner at Rockslide, I said, hey, we need to talk to Josh when we get a chance and see if he'll do some writing for us. He's really the kind of guy we want. So Robbie met you at the shoot in Bozeman last year, year before?
Yeah, it was a couple years ago. Must have been 15. We bumped into one. You called me.
I called you.
You called me that summer. I had been writing for Extreme Elk Magazine. I was writing the backcountry hunting column for Corey Jacobson. And I want to say that summer is kind of when it got folded into Elk Hunter Magazine, which is now being folded into Western Hunter Magazine. But that's a long story. But I'd been doing some writing for those guys, and I was kind of like, I figured I'd been doing enough writing. I didn't have enough time to do anything extra when you called me, but I started thinking about it after our conversation, and then I ran into Robbie down at the TAC.
I got a funny story about Robbie and you. I tell Robbie, if you run into Josh Boyd, talk to Josh Boyd, because he'll probably be down there, because I believe Sitka was part of that whole deal. Was that not?
No, this was
Mystery Ranch.
This was Mystery Ranch event, yeah.
And he's like, okay. So, classic Robbie, and I do the same thing because I have a memory about 2 seconds long. He calls me up and he's like, man, I met this really good guy named Josh Boyd. He seems like he'd be a really good fit for what we're doing. So anyways, didn't mean to interrupt you, but
no. And so, yeah, I actually mentioned the fact that you and I had chatted earlier that spring about writing, and he's like, we should collaborate on something. Let's talk afterwards. And right about that time, right around the Total Archery Challenge was going on, is when Corey announced that Extreme Elk was folding into Elk Hunter, and that freed up a bunch of my time. Because right. I didn't want to stretch myself too thin.
It's tough. Writing is hard.
It is. And the way I write is it's not efficient at all. I mean, I'll have to formulate an idea in my head for like 3 weeks. And then I'll write it on paper, and I'll let it sit there for 3 weeks. And then I'll go back and basically rewrite it, and then I'll tweak it from there. So it's not a fast process.
Well, and you have a family.
No, that too.
You have other obligations. And, right. And writing, people don't realize writing takes an extremely long amount of time because, you know, you actually have to write it and then proofread it and everything else. Doing a quick video or something else is so much faster, but people like to read, you know, they
right,
and it I enjoy reading a story much more than I enjoy watching a video, but that's just me, and everybody's different, so
right.
And people that write really well, like you, Robbie is a really good writer too.
He is,
even when I knew nothing about hunting, you know, I enjoyed reading his stories because it could pull me in, and I could imagine myself being there, you know, on this hunt with him as he's talking about these products or, you know, his whole adventure. And, and it's like that with your writing too. And that's really hard for a lot of people. Anybody can write a gear review, I think, and tell you all the specs and tell you all the details that you need to know, but not very many people can write a review encapsulated into their story on how they used it and how it worked for them and actually pull people in that otherwise wouldn't be interested.
Wow. That's good to hear. It's good to know.
And that's my perspective. I could totally be off base with how other people feel, but I doubt it.
Well, the biggest thing, not to cut you off, Josh, but the biggest thing that I take away from it is I read constantly, and I don't read all, I'm not telling you I read everybody's articles, but I'll read articles really fast to see if the guy knows what he's talking about, because I've read a lot of articles on backcountry hunting, and I've had so many guys send me, say, hey, I want to be a pro staffer, I want to write for Rockslide, and instantly the thing you hear from Josh is he knows what he's doing. When I read your stuff, it's instantly I can say this isn't Josh's first time, this isn't Josh's second time, he's put years worth of work into this. So take us how you went from, because I'm sure like most you went from being a day hunter, going up with your rifle when you were a kid, and how did that evolution come from Josh, the rifle hunting, day hunting, bow hunting, to being the backcountry
badass? Josh Boyd.
That's taking it a little too far.
Well, I have to say, I mean, when I think of, when you think of backcountry hunters, I think of, like Aaron Snyder and Josh Boyd. I think, I mean, you're in that talk because the stuff you came up, South Cox comes to mind. He writes some great articles back before he left Eastman's. Cameron Haynes back in the day. You don't see that much from Cameron Haynes, but he's kind of changed what he's doing.
Right.
But from the day one, those guys and you, I put a lot of legitimacy in you because just the way you write, you can tell you're doing it. So anyways, take me through that evolution of what changed.
I think a lot of it came down to the fact of that I was really wanting as much adventure out of my experiences as possible. And day hunting's great. I still do quite a bit of it. I do it in a different way. I'll do like really long, ultra long, like super far in day hunts sometimes where like by the end of it, you're dead and you're not doing anything for the next day. But I got sick of it. I got sick of dealing with people. The areas that I elk hunted, outside of Western Montana, Northwest Montana, they just became really popular and I kept seeing more people. The elk became silent basically. I would take 20 days off and go hunt elk in these areas, and there might be 2 days where I'd hear bulls bugle. And wow. the one factor that it came down to is there's just too many people there.
Right.
There's way more people there when I stopped hunting those areas than when I started, hands down. So I thought, I got to do something different. I love to backpack. I've always backpacked. I used to do a lot of climbing, which involved carrying heavy loads into the mountains. I used to ice climb a lot, rock climb, do a lot of trad climbing and a little bit of alpine climbing, mountaineering type
what's
of stuff.
What's trad climbing?
It's more like placing your gear versus like clipping bolts in a rock face. Gotcha. You know, there's sport climbing and trad climbing. Trad climbing is where you're going to a route that doesn't have any protection fixed on it, multiple pitches a lot of the time. So you like carry like cams and chalks and all your quick draws.
Yeah, that sounds.
It's a little more adventurous.
It sounds like
for sure. So I've grown up, doing that type of stuff, packing heavy loads in, and using backpacks and camping in places where most people would never go. Most hikers would never go. And so it was an easy extension to do that with
most hunters
hunting.
Wouldn't go.
Most hunters wouldn't go either.
I
yeah.
wouldn't.
And
when,
so
no. Like, when do you think you first got into that? What was your first big experience of backcountry hunting?
The first time I ever tried it, I was like in high school. And it was just an absolute miserable failure. I mean, we had horrible gear. This was back in like the probably late 80s. I had a pack frame that was made out of plywood that had a little shelf on it. Didn't have any padding on the strap. We were lashing our sleeping bags onto it and throwing in for dinner. We'd throw in a can of chili to heat up in the fire. And we were, didn't know what we were doing. So
that's the good stuff though.
It was fun, yeah. But we didn't kill anything.
No.
And, but it kind of
set. Thank
goodness. Yeah.
You wouldn't have been able to pack it out.
it might have ruined me for the rest of my hunting career, right. But that was when I first started doing it. When I first started getting serious about it was probably just out of college, I would say. In my mid-20s, I started kind of seeking a little bit more adventure in my hunting pursuits for sure. And that was kind of the pinnacle of like when I climbed as well. So I kind of stopped climbing around that time and I just needed something else to focus my energy on. And so I started doing a lot of backcountry stuff.
Did you notice more success, more animal encounters?
I don't know. I'd say I didn't have any more success hunting elk than other places, but I did know that if I went to these certain basins, I would never see another person. And to me, that was huge.
Was your focus mostly elk or deer?
Yeah, mostly elk. But I would hunt both, but I would focus elk in archery season for sure. And then once I'd get an elk out of the way, then I would, start focusing on mule deer, depending on what I wanted to do that year. Sometimes I'd focus on whitetail rut type of hunt.
I don't blame you there. That's a good Northwest Montana, Northern Idaho, they got some big deer. Mm-hmm. I didn't tell anybody that, but
no, it's yeah. To me, it is definitely underrated, but it's not easy. It's huge. It's big timber. Right. It's from valley wall to valley wall. It's giant timber.
It is.
And guys that want to hunt whitetails, I say come try it, but you're not going to be successful right away. It's kind of intimidating.
That's what everybody tells us.
It's a big patch.
Mm-hmm. It surprises people, yeah. I think.
It's a big patch. So on the backpack, on the backcountry pack, obviously backpacks being one of the key features. What was your first serious backpack you got into?
I'd say I started out using Arc'teryx and Gregory's, and that was just sort of those are holdovers from when I climbed a lot. That's what I lugged gear around. That's what I backpacked with. I still have my Gregory that I use sometimes, or I loan out to people, but it'll fit a full on elk quarter inside of it. And it's stiff. It's got a nice stiff frame. I got to say, recreational backpacks, they're not made to haul heavy loads anymore. Right. They used to be. They used to, because gear weighed a lot. So they made them beefy. They made them stiff. They made them, there was a transition, it seemed like, from like a rigid external frame pack to an internal frame pack. And they wanted them to feel kind of similar, be able to maybe hold the same amount of gear, the same weight of gear. And so some of the first internal frame packs had pretty rigid suspension and frames. And my Gregory that I still have, and my buddy, I have a good buddy that still runs his Arc'teryx, loves that thing. They're beefy. So those are my first real load carrying packs. My first hunting pack that I used was an old, this was back like when I was in high school and right out of high school, was a Dwight shoe frame. One of those Coleman frames with the Dwight shoe bag on it.
And it had
tons
of
people
black
had
rubber.
Yep.
I had one of those too.
And I hauled a lot of elk quarters out of the woods with that thing, but I was only hauling them out like a half mile, mile, three quarters of a mile.
Those are popular. Not rubber, black plastic.
Frame. Yeah, black plastic with the little clips that you can move the shoulder straps around in.
Yep.
And I think that thing's still laying up in my attic.
They were tough.
Yeah, super tough.
Super tough.
I think I backed over mine in my pickup once, and it was fine.
I've backed over a lot of things in my pickup. I usually don't look either. I usually just keep going.
So as far as like the more modern type of hunting-specific packs, my first one was a Mystery Ranch nice frame with a crew cab bag on it. And I also had like a 6,000 or a 6,500 bag that I put on it sometimes.
But what year was that?
Probably 2004, somewhere in there, maybe five. It's hard to, I can't remember. It must have been about four or five, 2004, 2005.
They really didn't, Mystery Ranch wise, didn't change much for
a long time.
A long time until about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago.
And I thought that was just awesome. That was like, oh, this thing's beefy. It can carry a big load. And I have a short torso.
Me too.
So I didn't have the issues a lot of the taller guys had with not having lift. I had barely had some lift on my shoulders, but not like some of my friends that were running that were, you know, they're 3 inches taller than
me. And
Josh
are built like Frodo Baggins. We're not very tall.
We're built for the long haul.
Exactly. We're dwarfs. We're very fast over short distances. But anyways, we have short torsos, so we had similar problems with lift. We don't have, I can run a 22 inch stay and, you know, far and have lift.
Right.
So you've used, fast forward, and you've used, and I see you have a Stone Glacier Packer. You've used Stone Glacier Kefaru, Mystery Ranch. Is there anything you're missing as far as packs out there that you've used?
I've used Sitka packs.
Sitka packs.
That's some of the very first 4500 they came out with. I've used a Kuyu.
Yeah. The original or the...
The original. I had the... Yeah. Yeah.
Gotcha.
And what else? I think that's about it. The big, I've used, Kefaru, Stone Glacier. I got one of the new GuideLite Mystery Ranches. I've used...
That's a nice looking pack. I haven't really tried that pack.
It is a nice pack.
It looks nice.
Mm-hmm. And I've used the new X-Lite. I had a prototype sent up last year from Kurt. I used it. Unfortunately, I didn't get any big loads in it. No. I backpacked hunted with it and I didn't kill anything.
You out of those, but you haven't used an EXO pack, have you?
That's one pack I haven't used.
Haven't used? Nope. And then there's also packs that I have. No, I haven't used the EXO or the Seek Outside, but they also make a pack that I haven't tried.
My buddy, I'm really familiar with the Seek Outside. Right. My friend Jared, you probably know Jared Lampton.
Yeah.
He has one. I hear loves it's a nice pack. He loves it.
I've not used that one, but I've used what I consider on Rockslide the big four, Stone Glacier, Kefaru, EXO. Not their new pack. I used the EXO's older pack and Mystery Ranch. And I am a dyed-in-the-wool Kefaru guy. If I didn't use a Kefaru, it would definitely be a Stone Glacier pack that I would use. I've never had a good, really good fit with a Mystery Ranch. Just they don't fit my body type. The EXO I tried first, I thought it kind of had a little too much flex. So that's kind of my shot on backpacks. But the thing on a Kefaru belt and why I like it is you guys might not know this, but I'm a little portly for my for my height. The Kefaru belt is the only belt I've ever used that when I lock it down, it don't move.
Gotcha.
Even if I'm not, I got no six pack abs. They're in there somewhere underneath the keg, but the other belts seem to have a little slip, especially when any pack works under 40 pounds. But once you get to that 60, 80, 100 pound mark, if that belt moves, it's going back to your shoulders. Mm-hmm. And once that happens, there's no point in having load lifters. There's no point in having a $500, $600, $700, $800 backpack because you have just the same backpack you can buy at Walmart. So that's just my thought on it, and I know you have your own.
What's your go-to pack, Josh, when you get ready to go on your first elk hunt of the year?
This year it was the Stone Glacier, the Sky Archer 6200. I have a pretty long relationship with Stone Glacier as far as like the packs that I've used. I use the first generation of Crux frame that came out with the Solo. And then also like their minimalist setup, like which basically putting a dry sack into the load shelf. Mm-hmm. I've used that. I've used their Sky 5100 bag, and then now I've used this 6200 Sky Archer. And then last year I used that. It's now new this year is the Sky 5900 with the X frame. I don't have one right now, but when I did use it, that would definitely be my go-to pack.
Is it that new frame that they just came out with? Mm-hmm. Did you use that?
That's the X Curve, yeah.
And you've used it?
I did. I used it last fall.
How do you like it compared to what they had before, compared to Kefaru, or compared to the other ones?
I think it puts them right there comfort level with Kefaru.
Nice.
Hands down. I like some lumbar support. The current Crux frame doesn't quite have it. It has some, but it's not built into the frame. It's more built into the pads in the belt. So it's comfortable, but it was less comfortable than, say, like the Mystery Ranch Guide Light frame with huge loads. It felt as comfortable with, like, say, a 70, 75-pound load, 80-pound load. But when you put two elk quarters in a stupid pack, everything's uncomfortable.
Everything sucks.
But some are slightly better than others. And I'd say, the Mystery Ranch carried those really massive loads more comfortably than this, than the Crux frame. The X-Curve frame, I'd say they're on par, if not more comfortable. And it's the same. I'd say it's as on par with the Kefaru. But my Kefaru experience is a little limited. I've only had the Timberline pack. Right.
Did you have the external or the frame?
It was the internal pack. It was the frame was built in. It was like the first generation of Timberline.
Yeah, the frame. I've had both. Like I've had enough Kefaru bags to buy a house. My wife will back that up.
Currently.
Even my daughter was knocking on me yesterday because I was knocking on, like, she had some shoes. And I was like, God, you have a lot of shoes. And she's like, well, God, you got a lot of backpacks. So I am kind of a backpack whore. And the hunting, the duplex hunting frame is, man, I have not used a curve frame, but compared to everything else I've used, it's the right amount of stiffness. I don't like... The biggest problem I have with packs is flexibility. I don't want that flexibility because I know that flexibility means when I want to do something serious with that pack, that flexibility is going to show its ugly head and I don't want it.
Right.
And that was a problem like the first generation of Kuyu packs that I broke had. They have way too much flex. That first EXO pack had way too much flex. I thought the Mystery Ranch had the flex. It just didn't have the comfort.
Gotcha.
So
Could be the belt.
Could be the belt.
It's a slightly different size and shape than a Kefaru.
I have run the Crux frame, and I think, like I said, I've never run the curved one, but I've run that one. And I think that is, if I didn't run a Kefaru pack, the Stone Glacier would be it for me.
Yeah, the X-Curve takes it to another level. Yeah, just the shape of the stays adds some comfort for sure, and it adds a little stiffness.
Does it have a good size lumbar pad in it?
It's pretty similar to this. The difference is the interface in the waist belt to the frame. It's stiffer. It's stiffer right here.
I grabbed it at the show, and it looked more beefy.
And they've changed the straps around the waist belt as well. So right now there's a single 2-inch strap that goes along, and they've switched that out to run a 1-inch on the bottom and a 1-inch on the top. So you can, with separate adjustments, so you can adjust the tension from the top to the bottom of the waist belt. That to me was a big difference. And then they actually have like reversible locking waist belt. So like a forward pull waist belt
really?
On the buckle. And it does lock down. Once you cinch that thing forward, it does not move. It does not slip.
On the lumbar pad, spin that around the camera. So what is new on the X-Curve frame compared to that?
I'm trying to remember.
It seemed bigger.
I think it is a little different, but the shape of the stays is different. So there's a little more curve going into the lumbar. So I think it might appear to be bigger, but it might not be any thicker.
Have you hauled elk out with that bag?
Oh, God, yeah.
How does it fit? How does it feel for you?
Good. Like I said, you put two quarters in there, you start lacking room.
Right. What is that setup again?
This is the Crux frame with the 6200.
Crux frame 6200.
It's the Sky Archer. And this is the one I was testing for Rock Slide. There's a thread on there.
Right.
That kind of went, I think I got the bag like about a year ago, roughly, and I used it all last winter doing work, like snow survey type of work. So skiing and snowshoeing and snowmobiling. I used it last summer to haul a bunch of equipment into a remote canyon where we were doing some stream restoration work. And then I take it to do like high mountain lake water samples. And then I use it all fall archery. I had a couple week window where I tested out the X-Curve frame.
I don't think he's bullshitting. I see blood on it.
Yeah, this thing hauled, I'm trying to think, it held my Montana elk in archery season. It hauled my Idaho elk, some of Brinker, like me and Brinker killed those bulls in Idaho. So, you know, that was a couple loads there.
Man, he is a dang good singer, not to like throw that tangent. Man, I thought
super talented.
I was blown away.
It is. How many cubes is that?
6,200.
And how many days can you get out of that for what you do, your style of backpack hunting?
Oh, God. I run it in bivy mode, usually.
Yeah.
And I can run it with the gear that I have. I can, and with food, you know, I can probably pack it for 6 or 7 days. If I threw the lid on and extended it out, I could get 10 days out of it easy.
I'm putting you on the spot here, but in your trials and errors of backpack hunting, is any gear you picked up and said, this is a piece of shit or broke on you?
Not to put you on the spot.
Oh, the very first Sitka 4500 that came out, it showed up at the house. I threw in like three weight plates, about 75 pounds worth of weight plates, and it just folded like a cheap lawn chair. It's like, this is not going to work with an elk quarter. There's no way. It'll be great for carrying camping gear.
That's what I hear everybody say is, oh, I love my pack. And it's like, well, how much weight have you actually put on it? Because any pack can be great with 20 pounds.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the first generation Kefaru, or not Kefaru, Kuyu, same thing. I put 375 pounds of weights in it, and I got one shoulder strap on, and I heard the frame crack. I'm like, well, that doesn't, I don't think that's going
to
work.
I don't think that's supposed to happen.
I'm not gonna
bash on it. I was like, man, I thought this thing had all sorts of R&D put into it, and it was designed to haul an elk quarter, blah, blah, blah. I was like, I can't even pick 75 pounds up without it breaking. I can't take this into the mountains.
Yeah, if you
There's
can't
no
even fit your
way.
Gear into it and have it not break.
That's where I really am a good tester, because I could fuck up an anvil.
Oh, he does. So, yeah, for sure.
the thing, the only pack that I've really ever had failure with is Badlands. And not knocking on Badlands. Mm. It's just, I broke a strap off one. I watched my uncle 2 years ago on a pack that I had given him. Both the straps went, and then the other one went. And he did have quite a bit of weight in there, but not like bashing on Badlands. I just don't think they're meant for what people are doing to them.
Not even close. I've seen the same thing happen last fall in Idaho. A gal.
With the Badlands?
With the Badlands, yeah. She was going to help us pack elk out. Ray shot two bulls on this hillside. And so we asked some people that we were with, hey, you want to help pack some meat?
Come on, pack some shit out. On. Help us
It'll
out.
And so I had a spare. I was using this pack, and I also had that mystery ranch in the back of my truck. And so I offered it up to this gal, and thinking, you know, throw a quarter in there, no problem. She'll be fine. Well, she shows up to the trailhead, and she throws on her Badlands pack. And I ask her, what's going on with that? And she's like, well, I don't like wearing other people's packs. They just rub me weird. And I'm like, well, you sure about that? She's like, oh, I've packed elk quarters with this before. And I'm like, all right. And in my mind, I'm thinking, man, something's going to break by the end of the night.
It's bad that they already have that mindset before you get to a place. Mm-hmm.
And so long story short, we come off the mountain, and in a snowstorm, everybody kind of got a little disoriented because we couldn't see the terrain. It was snowing so hard. So her and Brinker ended up coming down through some rock slides, and the footing was horrible. And then her strap broke on her pack.
Ugh.
And so they just kind of dropped their load right there and came out without any weight, which I don't blame them because it was gnarly. The footing was horrible. I just kind of lucked out and made it down through the rock slide without actually getting in the rocks. There's some little tiny fingers you could get through. But sure enough, that load of meat was left on the mountain because of a failure of a pack.
Yeah.
And I've seen it happen with other packs as well. Other Badlands. I've seen their straps break all the time, constantly.
Right.
And it's like, it's not designed for that type of use.
Right. I mean, the zipper, the biggest problem with Badlands is their zippers break a lot.
I guess I've heard of that too.
Yeah, the two that I've heard the most of was the Sitka packs and the Badlands, which they almost are similar in design and shape that I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's some of those specialty things happen for a reason, you know, specialty clothing, specialty packs.
Right.
I think that, you know, they call it boutique, but the Stone Glacier, the Kefaru, Mystery Ranch, those.
Yeah.
If you're seriously, you know, it's just like the top end optics. If you're doing it every day, there's a reason that people use the same top-end products that are in the field a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So
makes a big difference.
You're obviously a big Sitka guy.
Yes.
And I know you from experience. You've used a lot of other clothes.
Mm-hmm.
Why Sitka?
I started out like everybody else probably that's been hunting since, you know, the mid-80s. That's when I first started probably. I think I could start hunting when I was 12.
Man, we're old.
I know. It's pretty crazy to think about. But I remember like hunting with my dad wearing like old army surplus wool pants.
Yeah.
And then in bow season, I would wear army fatigue pants.
Right.
Everybody did. That was
the
thing.
Yeah, that's all that there was.
Yeah.
Sandwich bags on
after,
your feet.
You know, after hunting, you kind of, Cabela's would come out with some fleece. So I'd wear fleece, but those picked up burrs and the wind would blow through it and just wasn't functional. They'd get wet and the crotch would sag. And I hunted with fleece garments forever, you know, into the early 90s. And then after a while, I'm like, screw this. I'm going to start wearing, I have mountaineering clothes that are more functional, pants that fit better. They dry faster. They're just as quiet, but they're not camouflage. I'm going to start wearing that stuff. But then about that time, Sitka came on the scene, which was right around the time, well, that big whitetail we were just talking about, you know, I think they came out, they probably hit the market around 2005, 2006, somewhere in there.
I think you're right.
And they made a pretty big splash in a very small way. You know what I mean? It's like not many people knew about it, but as soon as somebody did, it just rippled throughout the industry. And I contacted, I was looking for some gear. And about that time, I was starting to kind of like pick up some sponsorship, like, but I shot for Bowtech for a while and G5 and seems like there's some other companies, but, I was like, man, I'd really like to, have some clothing. And these guys seem like they're headed in the right direction because this is where I wanted my clothing to go. This is what I was going to do other than the clothing I was going to wear wasn't camouflage. And I think it's fairly important when you're archery hunting, when you're being scrutinized by a bull elk at 25 yards, movement is mostly it, but I think having something to break up your shape, there's something to it.
That was Mothwing at that time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Mountain Mimicry.
Yep.
So that's kind of where I contacted one of the owners, and he's like, yeah, it's pretty funny. I was just talking to South Cox about the last Eastman's cover shot of this giant whitetail, and we were going to give you a call. It's funny that you called us.
Perfect.
Yeah, so it worked out well. I've been associated with Sitka ever since, so...
That's the easiest call to make when it's not a cold call.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what, like in particular, is it, do you, you know, because obviously Sitka has been, you know, a little bit up and down with their marketing schemes, but my really first use of Sitka was last year.
Oh, okay.
Like hard Sitka.
Mm-hmm.
I am and still do love First Light. But last year they sent me some outerwear and... You know, you hear that this is good, this is bad, but I never really had any, like anybody bitch or complain about Sitka, but I have to say after wearing it, their outerwear is really, really nice and really legit. And I say that I hunted 80 plus days last year and I hunted in some really shitty weather and you hear the knock on Gore fabrics, you know, from the competitors and you hear this, that, and the other. But I have to say after that year, looking back on it, I have... probably the best outerwear I've worn.
What were you wearing?
I wore the cold front and I wore cold front top and bottom in like late November because that stuff's really hot. I have a pair of the Cloudbursts, but I have to say the probably, this will sound funny, but the probably the two most impressive pieces that I wore from Sitka was the Jet Scream beanie and the Jet Scream jacket. And they're not waterproof. They're just windproof and they're amazing.
Yeah, I think the Jetstream jacket is or has been probably the most popular of their jackets, hands down.
I've never had that. I've never used, you know, Windstopper except for in a sleeping bag.
Mm-hmm.
I got a Western Mountaineering Windstopper on that bag. But the only thing I didn't like on the Sitka side was for some reason their polygene clashed with me and it stinks still.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh, interesting.
For me. I'll stay with Merino. First Light's Aero Wool is amazing stuff. But the polygene, for some reason, because I said it doesn't stink, and I believe it does, but I guess I have a unique body because it did stink after
both. Interesting. Yeah, that's because I've had
you have a unique body.
Yeah, you've got some unique organisms on your body, potentially.
Yeah, there you go. It did. I went back and I researched. I read every day on products and everybody said they love it, but for me it didn't work as well as like the new First Light Aero Wool. And I'm not trying to make this a First Light commercial, it's just general gear. That new First Light Aero Wool is ridiculously tough and zero scent after the whole I went on the whole Sitka hunt with it and it rained and you're buggy and nasty.
Yeah,
and no,
never
smell.
Dry out,
no smell in 9 days.
That's
I went on a 7-day elk hunt with the polygene stuff and then turned around and went deer hunting with her for 6 days with no washer, and it was that stuff was funky for me.
Yeah, but. I've had great success. I was pleasantly surprised with the polygene.
Yeah,
because synthetics have always been that way, notoriously stinky. Especially once you get them stinky, you can't get them clean. It's like as soon as you put them on, they instantly start smelling again. But for me, the polygene, I've worn one shirt for 6-7 days
really?
In the backcountry. I'm not saying it doesn't stink, but it doesn't smell like a normal Polypro base layer.
Like it should.
Yeah. When people say that stuff doesn't stink, let's be honest. It's not that it doesn't stink. It's just not offensive.
It's all relative.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because even after 4 or 5 days, I don't give a shit what I'm wearing. It's going to stink. It's going to have a scent of stank because it's just how your body works.
Yep.
But it doesn't stink like if the, like the Under Armour first cold gear.
Oh, man.
You wore that for 2 days and you smelled like a complete asshole.
And then after that, it would smell forever. The rest of the life of the garment, it would smell.
It's almost like when you put it on, you instantly have BO.
Yep, exactly. It's like, did I have some chili?
What the hell's going on here? No, I agree wholeheartedly. Another piece of gear, and I'm not trying to sway the conversation, is a Seek, you know, to rival Sitka. That Seek rain jacket I wore on Sitka really kept the rain out. But as far as you have ran, what is your favorite pieces of rain gear? Because they have, I think, four different kinds.
Four.
What's your top pieces from Sitka?
It depends on where I'm at and what the conditions are.
Year after year, like take us through what you go back to early, through all three seasons.
Early season for rain gear, I wear the Dew Point. It's packable.
Is that their lightest?
It's their lightest stuff.
Gotcha.
It's durable. It's not quiet, but it's no rain gear really is. Their new, I can't remember the name
Thunderbolt. The brush face stuff?
Yes, it's got the brushed face on it. That's going to be quieter.
Yeah, I did mess with that at the show and SHOT Show.
Right, I was going to say they're both shows. But the Dew Point, it's fairly quiet, but it's packable and it's light. And you always have it with you. If it's light, you're always going to throw it in your pack. Mid-season, I'll bring that as well. Potentially something a little beefier, like their Stormfront, which is just a heavier duty fabric. It seems like it holds up to the brush a little better. But it is heavy. It's not as packable. There's more features to it, like pocket wise and just the layout of the garment. It's more like all around functional. It's not as trim, so it's easier to like layer underneath, but I don't layer too much underneath. If it gets really cold, I wear a cold front, which is like there. So there's the Dew Point, the Cloudburst, Stormfront, cold front, kind of in that from that tier, I guess. That I guess it'd go from the lightest to the heaviest weight.
Yeah.
So the cold front has that fabric inside, like a little bit of a nap.
You might know this. Is the Stormfront the same thing without that fleece liner that the cold front has? Do you know that?
Pretty much.
And it has the Stormfront has pit zips, correct?
Oh man.
I believe the Stormfront does. The cold front does not.
The cold front used to.
The new ones.
But it doesn't now, if I remember right. They redesigned it a couple years ago, and I have a hard time keeping it straight in my head.
Yeah, and I hear all the time from the Stormfront, cold front crowd on Rockside, well, it's heavy. Well, if you really need that stuff, you're going to need that weight. Mm-hmm. You're going to need that for brush and for pure rain and driving snow.
I've never been colder than standing in a 38-degree rainstorm, which happens a lot in northwest Montana, northern Idaho.
Right.
It is brutally cold. 12 hours, steady drizzle, 38, 36 degrees. It is miserable. And that stuff is amazing in those conditions. The cold front is my go-to piece when it's that nasty out. And you will stay dry. You will stay dry in that stuff. At least unless you're really, really active or running around with it unzipped.
I had a cold front on, the cold front jacket, and I don't remember if I had the pants on or that I had this storm tight pant. Anyways, it was one of those days where you know it's just going to rain all damn day. There's Northern Idaho. It's just going to rain the whole day.
Maybe for two.
Yeah, for two or three. Exactly. You never know. And there's two things you're guaranteed in November where we hunt. It's going to rain and the wind's going to blow like a son of a bitch. So I literally sat up on this ridge with that cold front on, and I believe, I can't remember what I had for a insulation layer, but I believe it was the heavyweight Traverse hoodie. And then I had like, I think it was an Outdoor Research, like really thin down, like 7 ounce down jacket. And I stayed there pretty much the whole day. The next day was pretty much, no, sorry, it was 2 days later, it was pretty much similar, but I had on the Cloudburst jacket. And the difference is, I thought, well, I'm going to hike more that day. I thought it was going to be a better day. I got up there and it was just going to be a shit day. So I didn't hike as much. I just kind of, you know, really still hunted really slow. And the difference that I felt in feeling like the wind was getting through was unbelievable compared from the cold front to the Cloudburst.
Oh, yeah.
It was like night and day difference of cold coming in from the wind.
So. Well, it's just a thicker jacket. I mean, it's just going to be just a little bit more of a layer against that.
Yeah, that little fleece thing, I think it's just, and that jacket's hardy. So I sometimes wonder when people say that they use this and they use that. And then I get back in my head, I'm like, I wonder if they really use that in that particular application, because I have, and it doesn't work as well as people think. But that's.
Yeah, I mean, I have, you know, the luxury of being able to choose from several different sets of rain gear.
Right.
So, you know, the guy that doesn't get to use, you know, some of the the ones that he really should be using.
Yeah. Yeah, so and it is. You kinda, can't buy it all. It'd be $5,000 in rain gear.
It'd be ridiculous.
So we're lucky in the aspect we get to try all that. And I try to put my best, and I've seen you do it too, try to put your best foot forward to people. Well, if you're going to be in the situation, you're going to have one piece of rain gear, I would always opt for the little heavier rain gear for when you need it.
Exactly.
So
It depends on how you're going to utilize it. You know, a guy in Colorado that's going to archery hunt for 2 weeks isn't going to need a cold front.
No.
Versus a guy up here who's a diehard rifle hunting mule deer in northern Idaho. He might want to have a cold front if he's going to opt for a high-end set of rain gear.
Right, and then in Colorado, rain gear, I talked there, it's not even near as important. It's not. Rain gear is like the third thing on their clothing list.
Right.
Which kills me, because rain gear is the first thing I think about when I leave. Mm-hmm. So on the pant size, do you wear the traversed bow hunting, I imagine? Or do you wear something heavier for pants?
I usually wear the ascent.
The ascent. Yeah. I don't know why I was thinking traverse is the upper side.
Yeah. Well, the traverse, they have a traverse bottom too, but it's an insulated layer.
Damn, they got a lot of clothes.
They do. And it is even, I was supposed to be an expert at it, but man, I get confused all the time too. I get the language.
There's a book over there.
Yeah, we got a book. Just for
reference. But yeah, no, I wear the Ascent pants a good portion of the year. The new Ascent pant, which was launched this year, 2017, is incredible redesign.
Like 7 ounces.
Oh, they're so light.
And they hear they dry quickly.
Oh, that's amazing. I wore some a little bit this fall.
Did you?
I used some prototypes for a little bit after that hunt with when David and I were in Idaho. He handed me a bag of that stuff, and I used it for a little bit back in Montana.
Did you, like your general bow hunting, you know, hiking in, a lot of activity, what's your setup like bow hunting?
Clothing-wise?
Yeah.
It's pretty light, pretty minimal. Is that? Scent pant. I might throw in a core lightweight hoodie, and maybe like a traverse top and a rain jacket.
Cause that will be at the beginning of your season.
Yeah. So that's, so you know, starting early September,
quite a bit warmer.
As soon as it cools off though, I definitely will start throwing in well, it's even in September I'll do that. I'll throw in a Kelvin jacket, so like a puffy jacket. That's kind of like your safety net.
Right, right. Because you don't know that. I mean, it can change so quickly.
So, yeah, it's pretty minimal as far as like the clothing I take. But I also, I watch the forecast, long-term forecasts, which can bite you sometimes.
Oh, it did with me last year.
Yeah, so, you know. But I like to kind of ride that razor's edge a little bit and see what I can get away with. And
well, I mean, it's a good way to test things.
And I think that's the kind of the beauty of having premium gear, is it can kind of cross over into both those hot, cold, you know, and you won't die, I guess, at the end of the day.
Yeah.
You may be a little.
Yeah.
I think you're going to.
Yeah. Be a little miserable.
If I think I'm going to die, I'm going to go home.
I can't argue that.
Get out of there.
I think I'm going to die. Ryan's like, no, you're fine. Suck it up.
So moving on to like other gear, your glass, tripods, what do you run for that?
I have a pair of Leica 10x42s. That's my go-to optic. I mean, I've tried a bunch of other stuff, but I just keep coming back to those. Because I just can't. I bought them like in 2000 roughly. Mm-hmm. So I've had them 17 years now, and they're incredible.
17 years old.
Yeah.
Leicas.
Oh, they're awesome.
And they're probably everything you need.
Crystal clear. Never been refurbished. Nothing's ever had to be done. No warranty work's been done on them. They're perfect. The barrels are perfectly in line. Super clear glass. I love them. I've used, I mean, I don't pack a scope, a spotting scope with me all that much.
From where we live, where we generally hunt, you won't unless you go down south.
Exactly. Or you're hunting. I have used them mountain goat hunting though. Mountain goat and sheep hunting I've packed.
Trying scope. To figure out sex and age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you're looking at goats, a good spotting scope is a must. And I just sold my Leupold Gold Ring, 12-40. Yeah, I'm gonna pick up a Leica Televid body. I've got an eyepiece for it already. I just need a body.
I don't think you go wrong with Leica. They always say the big three. I call it the big two: Swarovski or Leica.
I totally agree.
I'm not a Zeiss fan, but I don't either one of those two. I don't think you'll ever go wrong.
Yep, I agree. So yeah, so mostly. High end glass if I can afford it, and rifle scopes. You know, it's kind of a mix.
Whatever you got, yeah. Throw it on.
But yeah, I'm a big fan of Leica for some reason. I have a Leica rangefinder,
right?
That I use. Yeah,
well, I think Leica ran the rangefinder thing until a long time till SIG came out this year, and SIG came out with that gem of a 2400.
Mm-hmm.
But the Leica 1600 used it for years, never had an issue with it.
Yeah, it's a great piece. The optics in it are just clear too. That's the nice thing about it.
Can't argue that. Yeah. And on the glass side, most of your focus is archery, correct?
It is. Yeah. I do rifle hunt.
Right.
But not a ton. But I will, and I like it.
Knocked down a bull last year with a 375, you said.
I did. Yeah. Yeah, and I shot one. I hadn't shot an elk in a long time with a rifle.
And, it's fun.
I went to Southern Idaho. It's a blast. I went on the hunt in Southern Idaho with Brinker, and I shot a bull the first day out, and that was the first elk I've shot with a rifle in a long time. And I thought, this is a blast. And we saw elk everywhere. It's like, we could go kill that. We were on it was the very last day of the season that we showed up there. So we had one day to hunt.
Yeah, oh so gosh. You guys bought out-of-state tags, one day to hunt, and you said, hell, let's do it.
Let's do it. Awesome. Well, yeah, I was balking a little bit, and Brinker's like, oh, we'll find elk.
Awesome.
Let's buy them. Let's get them. I'm like, are you sure, man? He's like, oh, yeah. Yeah, we'll have fun.
I like the positivity.
He was super positive. I'm like, all right, let's do it, you know? And we went out that afternoon that we bought them, and we glassed a little bit, and I don't recall if we saw elk that night or not. But the next morning, we just came up with a game plan. He's like, hey, let's. What do you think of hunting this ridge? And I'm like, yeah, I'm into that. And so we started up this ridge in the dark. We didn't know where we were going. And we both decided, well, let's just climb to the highest freaking thing we can see nearby and just sit there and start glassing because it's going to be light here real soon. And as we got to the top of this thing and we sat down and Brinker's like, well, there's a bull. And we look over, look across the canyon. Well, there's another bull. Well, there's another bull down there. We look back to the first one. Well, there's a couple more with that first one. Let's go over there and try to shoot some of those that are closest. And so we went over there, and long story short, we ended up killing one.
Is he always that lucky? I mean, is that just kind of...
I don't know. I've only hunted with him a couple times, but we've had great luck.
It seems like there's always people like that.
There is. But you know what? The thing that you get from Josh, or if you've been around David Brinker, is they're positive. They're not glass half-empty kind of guys. They're like... let's do it.
Let's just do it. And compared to Northwest Montana, Northern Idaho, which I've hunted a bunch in Northern Idaho for elk, hunting down there for elk is so easy.
We've hunted down there. Hunting elk down south is amazing.
Oh, man.
It is like, unbelievable.
Not Idaho, Southern Utah.
Oh, yeah, that's what it was. Yeah.
It's different. You can see very far away, and you can, I don't want to say it's easy because I don't think any hunting is easy.
It's easier.
Right.
It's maybe different.
And hunting up here, the brush country, you know, the nasty timber, being able to see something that you're going after is so much reassuring than being able to guess you're going after something.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
but tell us a little bit about that deer before we forget. You and Brinker shot 2 years ago.
Oh, the mule deer. Oh, yeah. So we shot. So the last day of the elk season, we killed that bull. I shot him at 35 yards.
Long shot.
Packed it out, and then the next day we hunted mule deer. We started hunting mule deer, and we glassed a big buck, big 3-point, like 160-inch three. But we just couldn't get on him. He was disappearing into the trees, And we were, you know, 2,000 yards away.
This wasn't right off the road, I imagine.
No, it's a ways in there. We had no idea where we were going in there either. But we just looked at a map, figured, let's go in here. The trail split. Let's go up this way. Then we just started heading off through the boonies. It's like, let's get to the top of this thing and start glassing. And didn't kill that deer, but we came out and we thought, we're going to come back and hunt this same basin tomorrow. So we hiked in further and climbed up to the top and started glassing. And like 2 in the afternoon, just we spotted one. Just he got out of his, he must have been changing beds in the middle of the day. Because he got up, was feeding for like 2 minutes, and then he wandered and we saw him bed down. And he was all the way on the other side of the drainage. So we had to circumnavigate all the way, kind of all the way around the head end of this thing. And we weren't sure how spooky these deer were, or how far our sound could travel, or how far they could see us moving, because it was pretty open down there. So we kind of tried to use the terrain the best we could. And we're both bow hunters, but we were basically pulling a bow stock off with our guns. And we ended up getting within 180 yards of this thing.
Wow.
And how did you decide who was going to shoot?
Well, we just both figured this is our last day of hunting. This buck's laying in his bed. Doesn't know we're here. We still need to get in a position to shoot. So I mentioned to Brinker's like, how about I'll crawl out there first and get set up on him. And if he stands up while you're getting ready, I'll shoot him. But you come out, you get set up, and then when he both stands up, we'll both just shoot. And that's basically what happened. Now, he didn't stand up. We both just shot him in his bed.
Yeah. There was no wrestling match or arm wrestling or nothing like that to decide?
No. And the nice thing, like we had talked about it earlier, it might have been the day before or something, we were talking about mounts and bringing home trophies and this and that. And he mentioned the fact that his son was asking him, Dad, why don't you have any big mounted deer? Why don't you bring home any big mounted deer? Because, you know, your buddy Tyler does. He's got them all over his house.
Why do you suck, Dad?
Tyler Johnerson.
Right.
And I don't know, I can't remember what David said, but after we killed this thing, you know, I'm like, man, you're definitely taking this one home, mount for your kid, you know? It's like, it's a gorgeous deer, beautiful, you know, 190-inch mule deer.
Yeah, it was.
I was super glad to be a part of it, but we both notched our tags. We were done hunting.
Yeah, that's
so
what it's all
it was
about.
And that was the first time we'd ever hunted together, so.
Really?
It was kind of fun to like, see what his style of hunting was and how, like, what his ethics were and what he thought. And we meshed really well, I thought. And so we went back again next year.
I was going to say, it must have worked out.
And then that was the whole, yeah.
That is a caveat I don't think a lot of people talk about, is hunting partners and how they can be so different in, like you said, ethics or styles. And boy, if you don't mesh, it isn't. Ugly marriage.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
It makes for a miserable trip.
Yeah.
And we're both diehard bow hunters. So it really, like, as far as like planning the stocks and stuff, it was a no-brainer. We're just going to stock them like we would if we had a bow in our hand.
Yeah.
And then shoot it. Like that first morning we were hunting elk, we saw there ended up being like 5 bulls. And they're all legal. So we were just looking for elk meat. So we were just going to shoot any bull. And we dropped across this little drainage and we got pretty close to them. They were all kind of in this quakies, like 100 yards away, but we wanted to shoot two at once. And so he would have a shot, but I wouldn't, but then I would have a shot and then he wouldn't. And you know, I looked at Brinker and I'm like, hey man, let's sneak a little closer. And he's just like, man, you are a bow hunter, aren't you? We're 100 yards away.
Let's just get right on them.
And we ended up, they started kind of moving off through the timber, and we hooked around and got right in the middle of them. And long story short, they kind of buggered, and I ended up getting a shot and killing that one at 35 yards. So,
yeah. And if you guys are watching the video, I'll get the pictures from Josh and I'll put them up on the video.
Oh, cool.
Because there's some good pictures. That deer is good. Brinker's bull is good. I don't even know if I've seen a picture of the bull you shot.
It's a little 5 point. It's
don't matter.
Yeah. It's well, that's what I shot this year too down there. It was a five point.
And then tell the kind of a critical thing you told me that I don't think a lot of people catch on. David had shot his bull, and then you had some people come down. What happened there?
Oh, for this year's bull?
Yeah, this year's
bull. So David shot his bull, and it fell in this opening, and there were bulls. We heard at least 5 bulls in there bugling that morning. He shot the herd bull, by far. It was a nice bull, over 300 inches.
Nice bull.
As we were walking up to it, there was another bull standing there in the opening. So I shot it, and it slid down the hill a little ways. So they were both dead 100 yards apart. And so we snapped some photos and walked down to mine and snapped some photos and butchered it back up to Brinker's and butchered it. And we were just finishing the butchering job, and it was probably 11 o'clock in the morning or something. And we heard somebody coming across the hillside above us in the opening. We were bent over, bone and meat off the quarters. And I look up, and there's like two younger dudes there, like maybe late teens, early 20s. And they kind of startled us. And we're like, oh, hey. And the one kid walks up, and he's like, hey, I think that's the bull we saw down in the bottom last night. And we're like, I don't know if this bull was down there in the bottom or not. It's a little ways down there, but there was five camps down there below us.
Right.
And they're like, yeah, we should have came up this ridge this morning. I knew we should have came up this ridge this morning. And so I asked them, like, oh, did you come up that other ridge, the opposite ridge? And they're like, yeah, because that was the ridge they were on the night before. And that would make sense. You know, you see them over on that ridge, come up that ridge. You're like, yeah, we came up that ridge. You're like, oh, yeah, I think I saw your headlamp down there at the bottom of the ridge this morning. And he's like, no, it wasn't our headlamp. I was like, oh, it must have been a truck headlight or something then. And he's like, no, we didn't start up that ridge till 9 this morning. I was like, 9? He's like, these bulls were dead for 2 hours at that point.
That is a key factor right there, because the number one thing I always get asked is, how do you kill animals? Well, to kill animals, you got to be there. So Josh and David were there long before daylight, correct?
Mm-hmm. Well, not that long. Right. We were standing on the ridge, you know, right at daylight. We were right where we wanted to be at daylight.
Yeah.
It took 45 minutes. It was only 45 minutes to get there.
You were there before you needed to be.
But we drove in on that main road, and right, there was camps everywhere. We didn't see one light on, and we didn't pass one rig as we were driving in there.
Oh, I learned that quick. And on my elk hunt, we almost had another divorce moment where we were having to get up onto a hillside before daylight, and there were things that were said. It's ugly, but it's important. You have to be there. Yeah. You have to be there.
I hate mornings, so it's hard for me, but you got to be there. Mm-hmm. And right. I be successful like you and David have been, I think you have to put in the work, and you got to hunt all day.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you got to put in the effort. And even then, you're not guaranteed success,
right,
but it helps.
Well, and it helps that both of you guys have the same mental mindset, because you're both really positive, and that helps push each other. If you were super positive and he wasn't and wanted to quit halfway through, it wouldn't make for a good hunting experience. That's why you have to be so careful about who you're hunting with, because people just don't realize that until it's too late that, oh man, this person has just sucked the life out of me.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Mental positivity helps, and just eagerness to go anywhere that, because my philosophy is, I'll go anywhere and shoot something. I don't care where it's at. Mm-hmm. Then I'll probably regret it.
I've had it at times.
Yeah. But at the, you know, it's like, I don't really care where I go, and I'll do anything. I'll go anywhere just about. And it's nice to have a partner that is willing to do that as well. One of my best hunting partners that I've ever had moved away a couple years ago. I do a lot of solo hunting. So that, you know, that gets taken out. The partner gets out of the equation. Mm-hmm. Right there, you got to have friends that are willing to go back.
Say, elk are so hard to hunt solo for that reason.
But as having a good partner like this guy, his name was Ryan as well. He was awesome. He was a great guy. He loved the backpack. He was eager to go anywhere, which was sometimes a little scary. It's like, you sure you want to go down in there? Yeah, sure. Why not? Like, all right, I'll go too then.
Yeah. Yeah, it's.
But those partners are tough to find. I mean, having personalities that mesh, you know.
Yeah,
it's like traveling partners. You just have to find personalities that match and are wanting to do the same things or hunt the same ways. And it's not as easy as I think people think. And they want to go with their friends because they're their friends, and they think it's going to work the same. And it is not at all.
Yeah, I've had a few hunts ruined because somebody just wouldn't quit bitching.
Right.
I said I was sorry.
It is long before Tanya hunted, but I'm with Josh. You got to find the right person, or I did hunt a lot solo, and you know, obviously the other game of that is hunting solo. It kind of doesn't freak your wife out, but it makes them nervous because, mm-hmm. you know, this was before we had sat phones and in reaches, and you say, hey, I'll be back here. And hopefully you showed up then. You know?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you can't always predict if you get caught up in a storm and then that sets you back a couple hours and I'm freaking out because he's, you know, giving these specific instructions. If I'm not back here by 9 o'clock, call so-and-so. They know where to find me, or call, you know, this person. And, you know, you're looking at like, okay, it's 9:30.
Or you shoot something.
Right.
Yeah.
And you're stuck there.
Yeah. Or you see something way out there. Like, well, I'm going for that. Next thing you know, you're, you know, 6 hours late.
Mm-hmm. You don't want to, you know, endanger other people by sending them out to look for them. But it's really a tough spot. That's why the sat phone's so it's worth every penny, honestly, I think.
You use a sat phone?
Yeah, we bought a Globastar. And
oh, okay.
It wasn't what it actually worked better than Alaska, which they said it wouldn't work, than it worked here. Worked here is shitty.
We don't really? Think, yeah. I think it's a pile of crap. I'm going to say it. I told
the rep that too. Huh. Yeah, I'd get Iridium or the text one, like the InReach.
That's what I use as a DeLorme InReach.
Form of communication, a text message, a phone call. We lend ours to friends when we're not going to be using it. It's so, like we talk about what I said, you know, your wife doesn't hunt, correct, Chris?
Correct.
Doesn't hunt?
Yeah.
And it's
she
really
goes a little. She'll go with me occasionally, but I wouldn't call her a hunter.
Right. Oh. It's so, I mean, I've learned so much and I have such a different perspective now that I've started than when before I didn't, but it's so scary. And it's not that I don't want him to go, or I'm telling him he can't go, or all of the, you know, universal debates you hear from men. Well, my wife's not going to let me go, or that ball and chain, or blah, 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 whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's not really. That's what people sometimes don't realize. It's not that we have an issue about you going. It's the contact. I need to be able to reach you if something happens here on the home front, or I need to reach you, or you need to be able to reach me if something is happening, or just touch base for 5 quick seconds. Hey, here I am. And it's that, I find that is the truth with most anything hunting related, is there's so many miscommunications about why it's stressful, or women don't want their husband's gone all the time. And it's just every little detail that you can take care of ahead of time or make not a detail is so, it changes the entire experience.
Right.
So I don't know. That's my 2 cents worth as the wife that didn't hunt, but now hunts. And it's just like, come on guys, it's not that complex. Get a stupid sat phone. Quit eating McDonald's 5 days a week. Throw that money into a sat phone. And then, you know what? I bet it'll change things for the better for both of you.
Right.
She thought that we always just waited to the last day to shoot stuff. She figured out that's not the case now.
Well, I figure that's usually not the case.
So, Josh, on the gear side, what do you take with you? You brought your bag. What do you take with you? What's your, every time Josh goes somewhere, you're taking it with you if you're hunting?
Northwest Montana bear spray, take it everywhere. I used to, and I have friends that still pack pistols, but I just don't want to carry the weight of a pistol, so I just pack bear spray.
Have you ever had to use it?
Not on a bear.
Wait, you had to use that on a person?
Was it on the hiker?
No, it was on some angry, vicious dogs that were in my carport.
Did it work?
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It got us all.
That's the problem. That's how I say it. Nobody wins when that for the military. Nobody wins when that shit comes out.
Yeah. There was like a back eddy around my carport of the wind. So I hosed them. They took off, but then the wind sucked it back into my carport.
And
I started calling. I had to run out. It was 1 in the morning. Man. Yeah, it was a kind of a funny situation, but I'm basically in my underwear standing out in the rain. In the wind-driven rain, coughing, burning, pissed off at some dogs.
That's what you call a shit show.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
That's awesome.
But yeah, bullets really don't, you know, don't blow back on you.
Oh, that's true, but they don't always stop them.
I pack bear spray. I don't even remember what I have in here. I should dig it.
Yeah, let's go through that. I'm going to get behind the camera so I can zoom in.
Oh, water bladder. So I've been using these MSR bladders.
How you like them?
Love them. They're super durable. I've had one for probably, I don't know, 6-7 years, and I finally ripped this part off the attachment.
What brand
MSR.
Yeah, it's an MSR, yeah.
Yeah,
nice. It's super tough. I've sat on them when they're full. Nothing. Yeah, it's been great. So I just bought a new one this fall.
I say that looks spanking new.
It's brand new. I haven't even used it. But this is a 3 liter. Yeah. I get as big as I can. You don't have to fill it up. That's
true.
It's not a rule.
It's not written down. You got to fill her up. Yeah, and honey, good thing hunting about around here, there is quite a bit of water.
Yeah. Yeah. Food bag. My stove. A lot of people ask me, like, what stove do I run? I don't use a Jetboil stove. I use a Soto. But I modified the bottom of this thing. I just kind of cut some slits out of it to fit my Soto. And the Soto burns more efficiently, uses the fuel more efficiently.
Luke Moffin on Rockside did a write-up of three stoves.
Oh,
did he?
The Soto?
With how you did that.
Oh, okay.
That was by far the best.
I mean, that thing is just weighs nothing. So
how long have you had the actual Jetboil part?
Probably maybe 5 years.
No problem with the bottom?
It's starting to come apart. So the fins, the heating fins are starting to get...
probably a couple hundred mils or so out of that thing, I imagine.
Oh, God, yeah, a lot. So eventually, probably this fall or this summer, I'll probably pick another one up. But I love this little Soto stove.
Nice.
It's super fast. It's lightweight.
I do like the Sotos also.
Yeah. So a lot of people are always wondering what I pack for a stove, and they think it's a Jetboil, but...
It kind of
The cup is.
Kind of not.
Yeah.
It's a hybrid.
It is. In a good way.
The efficiency of the Jetboil, that little fin thing, is amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. What else is in here?
It's like a treasure trove.
Yeah. So I've been using these Mountain Laurel Design Cuban fiber bags.
Oh, those are cool.
For my kill kit. So I'll fit all my game bags in there with knives, flagging, some cordage.
Nice.
And it's just a nice, convenient way of carrying stuff.
I do this too a lot. I do that all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Just put them there because they're just so nice.
You never know when you're going to need one.
I like the size of that thing.
Yeah, and they make a bunch of different ones. So there's a little small one. I don't even know what's in here. This is my awesome first aid kit, which I found out is lacking this fall. It's like,
what were you lacking? What part
was the lack? Well, my first aid kit is Tenacious Tape and Moleskin and Quick Clot. Doesn't get you very far when you cut yourself.
Super glue. She showed me the light on super glue.
I wished I would have had some.
So they make all different sizes on that Laurel Design?
Yeah, little one. This is like my survival, like fire starter, pitch wood, that type
of
stuff.
Cool. This is Mountain Laurel Design.
Yep.
That's broader proof zipper. Nice.
Yeah. So those things come with me all the time.
This is the lacking first aid kit. I lack a lot of things.
This is my sleeping pad that I bring. And I'm using a NeoAir X-Therm.
Is that compared to the X-Lite, have you ever used it? Is it crinklier or not as crinkly?
It's not as crinkly. And you know, they don't maintain that sound after you use them for a while. But I've had this one for, I want to say I bought it in 2012 maybe.
And it's gotten quieter.
It's gotten quieter, and I've never put a hole in it, not once.
I just got the X-Lite last year. Used it twice, and it was crinkly.
So this is their warmer version.
More insulation.
And it's only, I think it's 15 ounces. But, I mean, I've eaten burritos.
Shit, that's not bad.
Bigger than that, probably.
I'm taking shits big. I'm taking shits bigger than this.
That's nice. So I've heard. I don't carry these all the time, but I do carry some Black Diamond Z poles. I use them some of my shelters, but I also just use them to I'm packing out heavy loads.
Aluminum?
Yeah, those are aluminum. They make a carbon version as well, but I went a little cheapo and bought the aluminum.
You know, I've had...
You save a couple ounces if you go carbon.
I've had probably 4 or 5 sets of trekking poles, and the only ones that lasted aluminums.
Yeah, I've broken too many carbon ones.
My fat ass just smaps these carbon ones.
I've broken them going through blowdown. You get a lateral load on them and they just snap versus aluminum bends more.
I just fall down.
But these are kind of the older ones that don't have, the new ones have a little bit of an adjustment on the
Does yours the pop shaft up? No.
Yeah, they just go like this.
Gotcha. Never use the Z-pole type.
So I like to keep them in my pack for carrying out like a heavy load.
I take it they have different sizes something for us short folks.
They do.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet. And then I also use it as a pole for some of my shelters.
I've just used the flick lock. I've never used the inline. These are cool.
Yeah, so they're pretty handy.
Yeah, they are.
And then,
do you usually just pack those around in your bag the whole time, elk hunt, until you have some awkward load?
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, if you can strap your bow or your rifle to your bag as you're hiking out, you can have at least one pole in your hand, if not two. I've loaned one, you know, given one to one person, to right, your,
yeah,
buddy,
I give
or whatever.
Mine to Tanya half the time when we're getting to a place.
Just getting a nice third point of contact on the ground.
Oh, with those water crossings.
Or really super steep hillsides. When that load wants to swing you around, it's nice to have something to kind of hold you back.
I agree, wholeheartedly.
So I use a, depends on the time of year, but this is a little Jimmy Tarp Granite Mountain, I think is his model.
It's from Jimmy Tarps?
From Jimmy Tarps.
Yeah, I see him selling stuff on.
But
Rock
this Coast. Is this is the Granite Mountain, and he only made a couple of these in the Cuban fiber. I want to say that's like 7 ounces or something.
But that fiber stuff is crazy.
It is crazy. And that stuff is incredibly durable.
Have you had this in like a nasty storm?
Yeah.
And it didn't leak at all?
No, not at all. I had it in a gnarly windstorm. I thought it was going to be shredded in the morning. And I woke up and it was fine.
Awesome.
Let's
look in this.
But I use those poles to set it up. Use one of those poles, actually. But I use also some other shelters. Like I've got a... What do I have? I've got a Hilleberg that I tested for rock slide that I use if it's really nasty, really wet. I've got a Black Diamond. What do they call that? Megalite. It's a floorless mid.
Like, is it nylon?
Yeah, it's still nylon. Those are kind of my main shelters. It is crazy. It's super light and it doesn't stretch. It doesn't absorb water. It floats. Basically,
and we talked also about
it's super strong.
You use a quilt. I mean,
I do use
quilt.
A quilt.
You're a quilt man.
I love quilts.
Hey, I think you got to. That's what you got to test it out.
So
for.
This is a 10-degree Enlighten equipment. I think it's a regular, and I think I got it slightly wide because I just like to have it draped over me. I want to say it's like 22 ounces or something like that.
It's the same size I had. Yeah,
and I love it. You know, I wear it as a blanket. I can throw it over my shoulders if I want and glass with it.
I've never gotten cold.
I've never gotten cold with that thing.
Do you do like strap it down?
I hate that. I won't strap it down at all.
Around your neck?
Nope. Mm-mm. I'll wear a stocking hat and I'll leave it. I'll kind of tuck it under my shoulder slightly. But my legs have to be, they got to have room. I'm a side sleeper. I'm a side sleeper.
Me too.
Side and belly.
Do you roll around at all?
A little bit.
I think that's the thing that I roll around a lot. But you have had it down.
But here's another thing I do use. I don't have it in here with me, but I do have a titanium goat bivy that I do use it a lot inside of. So it kind of keeps it more contained.
See, I use mine like I think I have a Bora bivy.
Okay.
And mine was just, I'd wake up and I'd have a big air pocket and I'd be cold. But I sleep really hard and I guess I don't pay attention when I move.
Right.
But I'm not, like I said, we didn't, Aaron did that one. I don't knock on quilts because I know a lot of people like them. But
yeah,
for me, I think that's where each person's got to go check it out.
Right. What else I got? Oh, that's my water filter.
That's
an MSR.
That's just a little guy.
It's a little guy. I haven't had too many issues with it. You got to back flush that one quite a bit.
Which one is it?
The Micro Light or something like that.
That is light.
Yeah. And I've pumped a lot of water with it, never had any failures, never had it give up. I always carry a little backup, some pills, you know, as a backup.
I don't blame you there. A little glow stick.
Oh, I've never used one of those. That's pretty light.
I think that Cuban fiber stuff is probably the coolest thing that I've not used.
Can we take a little break?
No, we're about wrapping up.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to say, I got to...
Got to go pee-pee?
Mm-hmm.
Me too.
So old guy bladders.
All right. Well, we're actually into this an hour and 40 minutes.
Are we really?
An hour. But wow. Obviously, we like to talk about hunting and gear, so it dragged on a little longer. And then Tanya, you know, you can never get Tanya to shut up. She talks all the time. But anyways, Josh, I'll have you on again. I really appreciate you coming down and doing this.
Yeah, you bet. It's been fun.
It has been. All right. I will see you on the next show.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Josh. You guys.